Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, we're talking with Tim Brady about his new biography of Theodore Roosevelt Jr., entitled His Father's Son, The Life of General Ted Roosevelt Jr. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Sure. I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. I've been a writer for 25 or 30 years. I began as a fiction writer, went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop where I studied, got my MFA, and moved up here 25 years ago and began a freelance writing career. And I've written for a number of magazines, and I spent some time working at the Twin Cities Public Television, particularly working on documentaries. We worked on a series in the 90s that was called Liberty, the American Revolution, which was sort of a Ken Burns style documentary history of the revolution. When I left there, I got involved in freelance writing of history. I wrote for a number of magazines and began writing books about 10 or 12 years ago. The Ted Roosevelt biography is my third book that has a sort of World War II background to it. The first one was a history of a incident during the invasion of North Africa in Morocco called 12 Desperate Miles. The second was the story of Ernie Pyle and perhaps his most famous World War II column, which was written about a soldier who was killed at the Battle of San Pietro in Italy. And this one evolved out of the same sort of circumstances. My general interest in the war and looking for specific colorful characters and incidents that I could write about.
Well, you make it very clear in your book that Ted Roosevelt is a very colorful character. In fact, you open it by describing him as a young boy in the Rough Rider camp in 1898 after his father's return from the Spanish-American War, and they're the process of wrapping up the unit. And you set him there as this young boy watching his father. You talk about the influence this had upon him. And I wanted to start our discussing the book by talking a bit about that. What sort of influence do you see Theodore Roosevelt having upon his son?
Oh, his father, I think, was everything to the boy, the young Ted. I think that he admired him greatly, and there was a lot of hero worship involved. But his mother too was a strong influence, and both sort of guided young Ted into the life that he led. His father, again, was the heroic man, the guy that Ted saw from his father's office at that camp on Long Island after his heroics and at San Juan Hill. His mother was more of offered more of the Puritan background to him, but both influenced his decisions and his life and his sort of moral temperament.
Mm-hmm. And that dynamic really stands out in terms of the patterns that you return to, and we'll be discussing those patterns in a bit. But I was also struck by another dynamic that you refer to throughout the book, which is the interaction between Ted Roosevelt and his siblings. And it was a family structure with which, you know, many people are familiar with, but you go into greater depth in terms of talking about his half-sister and his brothers and his sister. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to that, you know, his brothers and his sisters, and whom was he particularly close with, and how did some of those relationships play out, especially as children?
You know, it was, they had a very interesting family, as all of the literature and the recent recent television documentary reveals. You know, and the children were individuals within the family, and they were sort of designated as such. Alice was the wild child. She was the half sister, the oldest, the daughter of Theodore's first wife, who died soon after giving birth to Alice, and Alice was subsequently left to be raised by Theodore's sister for a couple of years while he went off to his ranch in the West and communed with the cattle and nature for a while. Ted was the oldest boy. He was born next. He was followed by Kermit, and Ted and Kermit became a set of the match pair as the older brothers, and Ted was viewed as the sort of solemn elderly brother who was a little bit Ted had a crossed eye from birth onward, and was small like his father, and had a bit of a chip on his shoulder because of these things. So Ted was always he was both the son who was expected to follow closely in his father's footsteps, but also he was the sort of picked on boy, or he at least viewed himself that way. Kermit was more of the artistic Roosevelt child, and he was thought to be more sensitive than Ted. The middle girl suffered from that status as the middle child, and she was close to Ted, but she was sort of offset from the two older boys and the two younger boys, Archie and Quentin. And Archie and Quentin were the other match set. Archie was kind of the he was, of all the Roosevelts, he was perhaps the most dour, and he was sort of, he grew up to be kind of a depressive character, and had those traits somewhat from the beginning. And Quentin was the golden child, and Quentin was the child all thought had Theodore's brilliance, and all thought and people felt that he was the great things awaited him when he grew up. Unfortunately, he never got that chance.
Mm-hmm. And of course, because of the nature of the family, they grow up at different stages in Theodore Roosevelt's career. And that's one of the things that makes their childhood very different from so many other presidential children, which is, whereas so many children of presidents usually are adults by the time their fathers have become president, their childhoods coincide with this period which Theodore Roosevelt becomes a national figure and then enters the White House. And as you describe, as Ted Roosevelt is growing up, as he's going to Groton and then to Harvard, it's happening while his father's in the White House. So he becomes a celebrity in his own right.
He does, and so do the others. But Ted, I think, was at a particularly vulnerable age when all of this happened. He was he had barely arrived at Groton when his father succeeded McKinley as president. As a matter of fact, it was in Ted's first year there that McKinley was assassinated and Theodore became president. So it was, you know, he didn't like the attention, and he continued not to like the attention for the most part in his adolescence and childhood. When he went off to Harvard in 1905, he was trailed by a pack of reporters And he went off for the football team that fall, and his every doing on the football team was reported in the national press. He was a freshman on the freshman team, which, you know, wasn't though Harvard football was the best in the country at the time, or one of the Ivy League football was the best. Ted was, as I say, just a freshman defensive end weighing all of 140 pounds, and there were newspaper reporters on the sidelines watching his practices. He didn't like that, and he sort of it added to a sense of the chip on his shoulder. And but all of the Roosevelt children were provided fodder for the press at that time. Alice was in particular a favorite, and she, as opposed to Ted, relished that attention.
As you mentioned, Alice gets married around the time that Ted goes to Harvard. So she goes from being a debutante to being the wife of Nicholas Longworth. And as you mentioned, they go off to their honeymoon. And it's almost as though that attention that she was receiving from the media then sort of shifts over to the next eldest Roosevelt, which happened to be Ted.
Yeah. And it was again, a great burden to him, or it felt like a great burden. She went off on a tour to the Far East, and that took her out of the daily press for a brief while. Though via telegram, she was still making news on that tour. But that sort of meant that the press could focus on Ted, who was the eldest Roosevelt, and there he was at Harvard, and so. Reporters from the East Coast dailies went up and covered him.
Mm-hmm. And his performance in school was not necessarily what one might expect, because his father, when Theodore Roosevelt was going to Harvard, he excelled academically. He did quite well. And yet you described that Ted at Groton and Harvard wasn't quite the academic star. What was his school experience like in that respect?
He wasn't. He was a mediocre student, and he was also he kind of began sowing some wild oats while he was in school. He joined the clubs and started to go out and have himself a good time, and he like all the Roosevelts, he had a kind of a wayward or an instinct to wander around, and he always had interests, nature interests, and so he would go out and go hunting, and he went to a boxing match, and which was a typical Roosevelt thing to do. And the press found him at the boxing match, and he went to a rodeo up in Buffalo, New York, and participated in the rodeo. And you know, for his parents, who were reading these reports when he's supposed to be studying up at Harvard in his freshman year, they're wondering what is going on. Mm-hmm. And his father took to calling him Pendarvis, who was a character from a Thackeray novel, who was sort of always getting into, who had gone off to school and was always getting into trouble and had to be bailed out by a rich uncle. And he would write to Kermit, who was at Groton at this time and becoming a favorite correspondent of his father, about his son Ted and Ted's wayward ways. And so there was that interesting dynamic within the family too. Kermit became the confidant for Theodore in talking about Ted. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, of course, just his father or his siblings that were commenting on him, but as you mentioned, he received a lot of commentary from his peers who viewed him as, you know, the president's son. And there's you mentioned a nickname or two that he acquired at Groton at Harvard that was basically implying that he was the president's son and he didn't actually, measure up to. Go ahead.
He was nicknamed first boy at Groton, and which was something that he hated, and he was always someone at that age quick to raise his dukes if he felt some umbrage at a slight, and that prompted yet another fight in his career. But he was a sensitive kid, and his response to this was usually he liked to wrestle, he liked to box, and his father was not averse to these things either, and he would sort of lecture Ted on the one hand about getting into trouble, on the other hand he would write to Ted saying things like, you know, I don't want you to pick fights, but I never want you to turn down a fight if it's necessary or you feel like you're defending principles.
It's a bit of a mixed message there.
A bit.
Yeah. I also you suggest in the book that it's in a way it's almost at play with football. Because when he's playing football at Harvard, you emphasize just how small he is relative to the other players, and how he compensates for that with this determination to really prove himself, and that's a dynamic that seems to be repeated throughout his career. On the one hand, he is the namesake of Theodore Roosevelt, who is this incredibly dynamic figure, the proponent of the strenuous life. And that comes with a set of expectations. And he, as you mentioned, he sometimes resents that. But at the same time, he doesn't seem to go in the opposite direction and reject that, become this laid back, dissolute figure. But instead, he endeavors, as much as he might resent it, to live up to those standards.
Yeah, and speaking of his football at Harvard, I write a chapter that's sort of devoted to one particular game that he played against Yale as a freshman. There was a famous photograph that evolved out of that game of him being helped to the sideline, battered and beaten. He's two teammates are propping him up. He between the teammates and his arms draped over them, and he looks like he's gone 15 rounds with Jack Dempsey, but he's being dragged from the field, and that was his character. This was after a game in which he was out there playing defensive end and getting just pounded by Yale, which had a much better team and much bigger team, but he continued to subject himself through this whole game to the pounding that he was taking until he was finally knocked out of the game. But just as you suggest, I thought that really suggested his character, and a character that would go on and on throughout his life. He was someone who's essential being to me was that figure, that guy who was willing to stand out there and take it for whatever the cause was, and the cause was usually related to his sense of who he was as a young man, as the son of Theodore Roosevelt.
I remember this one letter you quote from that you cite when Theodore Roosevelt, when Ted's broken his nose again, and how he sort of shrugs it off by saying, well, it fixed the deviated septum for the previous time my nose has been broken.
I liked that too. Yeah, it was actually a letter to his mother, I'm sure his father would have appreciated the sentiment that he had to assuage his mother some way about the fact that he'd yet again broken his nose. So.
Another example of that I thought you describe in the book of his unwillingness to, in a sense, exploit his status as the son of Theodore Roosevelt is when he leaves Harvard. And I was wondering if you could speak to what he does after he sets out after he graduates from Harvard and he goes on.
His first adult job was on the floor of a carpet factory in Connecticut, and he took this job because he understood through having it drummed into him by his parents that he had to shape up, and he decided to do that by just going in at essentially a minimum what we would call a minimum wage job, working on the floor of a factory, a carpet factory in Connecticut. And, there are some asterisks that have to be attached to this, because he did so and had his taking this position reported on and by the New York papers. So it wasn't as if he was an anonymous laborer going to work at, and he, you know, this was the last year of his father's presidency. So he was still very much in the news, as were all of the Roosevelts. But yet he took this job, and he continued to work on in this carpet factory for 3 or 4 years, moved with the company to a position in San Francisco, and actually acquired some skills in the business. He was said to have a good feel for carpets, which I don't know anything about the carpet business, but I understand that to mean that to judge a good carpet, you have to be able to touch it and feel it and assess it, and the fact that he would learn something like that gives a sense of who he was as a character. You know, he was someone who was willing to learn, willing to slog through a position to grow as a person.
He was not willing to just trade on his name and let that carry him through life as he very well might have.
I think it was one of his most admirable traits. He was never willing to do that. Again, I would put a little asterisk on that by saying everyone knew who he was and he had that benefit, but yet he didn't push it. And it was really a great trait of his.
This is also the time when he gets married and starts a family, and I was wondering if you could talk a bit about his wife, Eleanor, and the life that they started for themselves.
Eleanor and Ted were, I think, a great match. Eleanor was this sort of a slow-eyed, petite young woman who had sort of a tough family situation, complicated family situation. Her mother and father were divorced and remarried and divorced again. But Eleanor had a sort of a tough spirit and was an independent woman. They met when he was working on this carpet factory, her family came from Wall Street money. Her father was a Wall Street lawyer, who, by the way, Theodore really disliked. she had been raised in Europe, primarily going from one well-heeled family member to the next with her mother. came back to New York and went to finishing school, met Theodore. They married, moved to San Francisco for 2 or 3 years, and then came back to New York when Ted took a job with a Wall Street firm became a bondsman on Wall Street.
And yet, as you explained, that is not initially what he wanted to go into, because when he's preparing to leave Harvard, he talks to his father about going into the military, and his father dissuades him. And so when he goes back to New York and he begins working on Wall Street, you describe how he also begins to get involved in the preparedness campaign. I was wondering if you could set the context a bit about what was happening during that period and Ted Roosevelt's entry into military life.
During the beginning of World War One, Theodore became a quick and strong proponent for U.S. entry into the war. And Ted followed suit, and part of that impetus for Ted, anyway, entailed going off to a camp in upstate New York, where he began training for military service as an officer. These were camps that were actually organized by a number of young college men, Harvard grads, as well as Leonard Wood, who was Theodore's commanding officer during the Spanish-American War of the Rough Riders. The idea was that they would college students or college men and Wall Street types would serve as an officer corps in the same way that the Rough Riders combined the Ivy League types with rough and tough Westerners to form a very democratic military corps. This this is all prior to the U.S. entry into the war. The camps were established by and for people who were generally advocating for entry into the war and wanted to be prepared. They were Theodore and this company of men were terribly concerned that when the U.S. entered World War One, it would be unprepared, and they wanted to have a corps of young men ready and able to enter into the U.S. military to help lead the efforts in France.
And this is one of the reasons why when the United States goes to war in April of 1917, Ted Roosevelt Jr. is able to be among the first contingent of soldiers who is sent to France from the United States.
Yes, Ted had reached a role of leadership within this upstate New York camp and entered into the war, World War One, at the level of an officer and he was a major at the start of the war because of this because of his work training in these camps, and he quickly became assigned to the 1st Division, which would become a famous division both in 1st U.S. Army Infantry Division, both in World War One and World War Two, and he was one of the first to get to France. He was one of the first on the front lines. He was always very proud of his association with that 1st Division.
Mm-hmm. And yet, even though he's going there and he is assuming a lot of the same challenges and sufferings that his men are, you also describe how he skirts the rules in a bit, and his wife skirts the rules. She goes over there just before a ban is placed upon wives going to France, and how they set up sort of a Roosevelt camp in Paris itself.
Yeah. And Eleanor arrived almost simultaneous to Ted in 1917. Eleanor had one of the places that that she had lived as a young girl or passed through with her mother was with an aunt's house in Paris, not far from the Champs-Élysées, she took up residence there and established. She herself volunteered to work for the YMCA, but did work for the YMCA throughout the war. But at the same time, this house became sort of a way station for the many Roosevelts who served in World War I, and when they passed through Paris, they could stop there for some R&R.
And among those Roosevelts, of course, were all three of Ted's brothers.
Yes. Quentin and Archie and Kermit all passed through, as did Ted. All four boys were proud members of the U.S. Army, and actually Kermit began service with the British forces in the Middle East, but he wound up back in Europe serving in the army in France.
Was there any sense, perhaps, of competition between them?
Oh yeah, they and the war brought it out too. They were so eager, and this involves again the upbringing that they had, and their sense of duty, and their need to serve the army. They had sort of a sense that in a way for the Roosevelt boys and for the Roosevelt families, the more dangerous the service, the higher the reward for them with their father. Theodore used the term "blooded" quite frequently, which he meant actually literally wounded. And when Archie, who was the first to be blooded, was held up by Theodore as an example of what the others ought to pursue. Now I say that there was no deep perversity in this. What he meant was that it was because Archie was Archie's wound turned out to be much more grisly than any of them thought, but it just meant there was a great deal of pride in their service, and to show that service, they had to be at the front lines was the greatest service that they could have.
I thought that came across really well with one anecdote you mentioned. I think it was between Ted and Archie, where Ted was trying to get his younger brother to serve in a safer position, not necessarily out of any sort of desire to outshine him, but because he was genuinely concerned for his brother, and how Archie effectively kiboshed that by saying, well, I'll serve behind the lines if you serve behind the lines. And as you described, that pretty much ended any discussion of that happening right there.
Right, right. And Quentin suffered from this because it would, with the ultimate price. I don't want to assign blame to any particular Roosevelt in this, but Quentin was terribly concerned through his first months of the war that he was not getting out into the combat the way the other brothers were. Quentin was a part of the fledgling Air Corps. The Air Corps was sort of stranded without any American-made planes. They couldn't get French planes to fly, to practice fly, and they subsequently couldn't get up in the air. So Quentin was grounded through from his arrival in France all the way into the middle of the of 1918, and his other brothers, Archie in particular, were pushing him to get out there and get up in the air. And Quentin would say, you know, I'm not being a shirker. I'm trying to do this, but there's just no way we can get up in the air to practice. And he felt bad because Ted and Archie, who were serving in the same unit in the war, were the first to be on the front lines for in the U.S. Army in the infantry. He was he couldn't get up in the air because he didn't have an opportunity. Of course, when he finally got up in the air, he was about 10 days into his flying service when he was shot down and killed in France.
What was Ted's combat experience like? Did he just see a little bit of combat, or was he pretty much in the thick of it throughout the remainder of the war?
He was in the thick of it for the first few months of the war, and then in the last month and a half of the war. He was in the first action of the U.S. Army in the war, and he served at a battle called at Soissons, which was a terrifically fierce struggle, and Ted was wounded there, shot through the knee, kind of a through and through that left him debilitated and out of service for a couple of months. But then he returned to the service at the end of the war and was there through Armistice Day. He was in the thick of things through most of 1918.
The impact of the war upon him, I thought, was best demonstrated by what he does right after the war with his involvement in the American Legion. I was wondering if you could speak to that, because it's something that doesn't often get as much attention in terms of talking about the Roosevelts, but how integral he was to the creation of the American Legion and the ideas behind it, which, as you explained, were in many ways very Rooseveltian ideas.
Indeed, he was there at the founding of the Legion, and in fact, I don't think it's too much to say that he was the prime mover behind the creation of the American Legion. In part because of his name and who he was, but also he truly believed in its goals. The Legion was begun really by veterans in France just a couple of months after the war. The general feeling was that they had gone to war and their service ended relatively quickly, and they were left waiting in Europe to go home, and there was this longing for something more. I'm speaking for more camaraderie, a greater sense that they had accomplished something, a greater sense that they had fought this fight for a reason, and they thought that if they continued the associations that they'd made in Europe back home, they could continue to affect life in the United States through their camaraderie and unity. And so Ted came home and after initial organizational meetings in Paris, and they continued organizing in the U.S. and the spring of 1919, there was a big meeting in St. Louis at which Ted was the figurehead leader of the group, and there was a universal cry for him to become be made the first president of the American Legion, but he declined. And this is another instance where he was very sensitive to his position as the son of the president and the recently deceased president in this case. And he didn't want to take advantage. He truly didn't want to take advantage of that. He thought people would consider it a political ploy, him forming his own political funders and backers in the form of these veterans. And he didn't want that. And I think that's just another element of Ted's. His sense of service and his sense of moral leadership,
and it also highlights, in comparison with his father, the degree to which his career was at a sort of a dissonant from that of his father. Because Theodore Roosevelt, in the late 19th century, he had gone to the state legislature. He had then, gone into a series of appointed positions before the Spanish-American War. So when he came back, it was in the space of a year, he goes from being Assistant Secretary of the Navy to becoming war hero to becoming governor-elect of New York State. Theodore Jr., he has the war record, he has the stature, but he still has not officially really begun that political career. You describe this moment in St. Louis where he has this entire assemblage of people, cheering him on. You say it goes on for an hour and a half of them trying to get him to accept it. And he definitely is demurring for that reason. But there also is a sense that he's not quite ready to take that moment. He's not where his father was at the end of his war in 1898.
That's very true. I think that he was just not, as you say, he was just not ready for it. But also it distinguishes him from his father, because his father was a truly political animal from a young age. And as you outlined, Theodore had this meteoric rise, which he sort of measured at every step of the way, even his entry as a, in the Rough Riders and in the Spanish American War were measured and they were calculated and everything he did from Assistant Secretary of Navy to the governorship to the vice presidency and then the chance of becoming president was something that in a way he calculated and he accepted and took advantage of. Ted, on the other hand, gets that opportunity to become a leader of a kind of movement, the Legion movement in St. Louis, and he decides he's not ready, and he actually takes what in a political sense was probably a big step backwards by following in his father's footsteps, by deciding that his first political step will be to run for the New York legislature, which he does in the fall of 1919 and gets a seat there and begins. But he's, by that time, he's too big for the office, really. But he's sort of being a dutiful son, because his father had made this first initial foray into the legislature. Ted feels it would be a good step for him to learn the ins and outs of New York politics, so that's what he does.
And that's where you also begin to, in your book, get into the dynamic between Ted as the now head of the Oyster Bay Roosevelts, and then the competition, if you will, with the Hyde Park Roosevelts, because Ted finds himself in a very unexpected position in 1919 because his father dies at the relatively young age of 61. People were talking about him possibly running for president in 1920. Now, all of a sudden, Ted is the next generation. And on the one hand, he has this, you know, sterling resume of being a war hero, but he has none of that preparatory work. Whereas by contrast, the Hyde Park Roosevelts, you have Franklin Roosevelt, who has followed virtually the exact same model of state legislative service, then Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And then in 1920, he becomes the vice presidential nominee. And as you described in the early 1920s, there is something of this competition of who is going to be that next generation of Roosevelts. What will the next generation, who will be the next, the Roosevelt of the next generation to assume political leadership?
This is a very interesting moment in this joint family history. Franklin has, just as you describe, has followed it. As Ted is beginning to do, and Franklin has been the Assistant Secretary of Navy through World War I under Woodrow Wilson, and a Democrat, and in the summer of 1920, the Democratic Party chooses Franklin to be the next vice presidential candidate on the party ticket, and suddenly the Theodore Roosevelt family becomes alarmed because Franklin is in their estimation usurping the rightful legacy of Theodore Roosevelt, mm-hmm. and not only usurping it, but if he's successful, he might supplant Ted, who is the leader of the Sagamore Hill Roosevelt family, and though Ted is, as we said, Ted is not quite ready to assume that position. So what to do? And as Franklin goes out on the hustings, running for vice president. And to back up a moment, it should be said that the Democrats are not exactly innocent about nominating Franklin for this position, because they're well aware that there are many people out in the electorate who will assume that Franklin is just one of those many Theodore Roosevelt boys who were running around the White House a few years ago. The Democrats are trying to take advantage of it, and the Republicans are saying, what should we do to counter this? And they ask Ted to go out and trail Franklin and be the truth teller and be the true Roosevelt to his fifth cousin, Faker.
And of course, Franklin Roosevelt loses in 1920, and Ted receives he's rewarded for his efforts by becoming Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And then, of course, in 1921, Franklin comes down with polio. And so for a period of time, it looks as though Ted is in the proverbial driver's seat, and that he is In well on his way to the White House. But then you describe what happens in 1923 and 1924, which really seems to throw a wrench in the plans.
Yeah, this is, I think few people remember this about Ted and Ted's life, that he was during that period when Franklin was first diagnosed and stricken. Ted was a far more was considered to have the far better political future than Franklin, and he was also a member of the cabinet, or actually an assistant member of the cabinet, but he would ultimately become Secretary of the Navy. At any rate, he's cultivating New York politics. His sister Alice plays a role in this. They're all they all have this notion that Ted will become one of the senior members of the Republican Party in New York and either become a U.S. senator or the governor of New York. And he is nominated and or wins the nomination of in the governor's race in 1924. But he's had a little problem as is in with working in Washington with the Teapot Dome scandal, which you'll remember was a famous Harding administration scandal that rocked the cabinet and rocked Washington. Ted was never deeply involved in the scandal, but that he was had a or was not and was never found to be guilty of anything in the scandal, but he was peripherally involved and tainted by it, and that became a troubling point in his political career. He ran for governor in 1924. And faced Al Smith, who was a New York powerhouse, and the race was tight, but Ted, it was not to be for Ted. He lost by 100,000 votes in the November 1924.
And you described that one of the most dramatic aspects of the campaign was that. During the campaign, you had a bit of public theater in which there was a car being driven around with a teapot attached to it, and that it, just to make sure, as you point out, to make it clear that the words "Teapot Dome" were written on the side of it to remind voters of this unsavory association. And what made it so especially bitter was who it was that was driving it.
It was a bit bitter and surprising. It'll be surprising for many people. Eleanor Franklin's wife, same name as Ted's spouse, by the way,
and a more direct relation to Ted than Franklin.
And, I should say that she was Ted's first cousin, the daughter of Elliot Theodore's. Dissolute brother who had died as a relatively young man and left Eleanor orphaned. At any rate, Eleanor and Franklin married, and Eleanor grew up around the Theodore Roosevelts, and there were a lot of interconnections and a lot of associations. Alice and Eleanor were as a recent book title called them hissing cousins, and so Eleanor was always around the family, but by 1924, with her husband spending most of his time now in Florida trying to rehabilitate his crippled legs, Eleanor became much more involved in political circles in New York, and trying to keep her husband's hand in things. And one of the things that she opted to do was strongly support Al Smith in the 1924 election. She did this by decorating a car, and just as Ted had followed Franklin around in 1920. Eleanor followed Ted around New York and as her own truth squad tried to with this paper mache teapot dome on top of the car, followed Ted around the state and tried to set people straight about his politics and his association with the Harding administration scandals.
It really does seem to be a very pivotal point in both their careers, because Eleanor is building up her stature. She's helping to pave the way for Franklin to be come Al Smith's choice to replace him in 1928. And it really seems that's the point at which Ted's career is derailed, and he never really seems to get it back on track afterward.
No, and it's a curious thing, and I think it involves sort of a study of New York politics in the 20s, which are really an interesting thing. If you think about how many New Yorkers moved on, many of them from the Roosevelt family moved on to the national stage as presidential and vice presidential candidates. You realize how important it was, and how precious were those New York State offices. Mm-hmm. Ted decided after 1924 to take up another aspect of his Roosevelt character that he probably also acquired from his father. He decided to go off with Kermit on a pair of lengthy adventures that were kind of combination hunting trips, explorations in Asia. And so in 1925, he began planning a trip under the auspices of the Field Museum out of Chicago to go to the Himalayas to hunt for, they were called Ovis poli, which is a big bighorn sheep that were first spotted by Marco Polo back in the 13th century. He and Kermit made plans to go off on this 8 or 9 month excursion to hunt the sheep to place in a exhibit at the Field Museum, and they did so.
Mm-hmm. And then they go back and they hunt a panda bear, and he makes it back in time to campaign 1928. And while he is rewarded with positions in the Hoover administration, they're not quite the positions that he was hoping that he'd get, commensurate with his name and the service that he'd been providing.
Yeah, and I think by this time, though he didn't quite acknowledge it to himself, or and the family didn't quite acknowledge it to themselves, but I think he was on sort of a downward slide from being thought of as in the highest echelons of Republican figures, and I think he was always a loyal and dutiful party man. He would go out and use the Roosevelt name to spread the word about Republicanism, I'm blanking on the word for in Puerto Rico. He became the the governor of Puerto Rico, but it was Puerto Rico was not the highest office that in the diplomatic corps that he might have achieved. And he did he did the dutiful work, and he was considered a very good governor of this of Puerto Rico, and very helpful during the depths of the Depression for this impoverished state, and looked out for their interests. But it was not quite what he wanted. And again, his sister Alice was there to point out that wasting his time in San Juan and needed to get back to Washington to a different, more prestigious post. And ultimately he did. He got the Philippines were a far more prestigious post in the diplomatic corps, and he got that as his next position but it coincided with the 1932 presidential election, in which Franklin once again appeared in his life.
Mm-hmm. And at that point, given the Great Depression and the damage it does to the Republican Party, you know, his political career is effectively at an end. And he's not even 50 years old. He experienced his entire rise and fall in politics before he even reaches a point at which some people just begin their political career.
It's there's really something a little bit sad about it, because I will say that I don't think Ted was ever a great politician, and I think that if this hadn't occurred, something else would have prevented him from assuming high office. But he did have tough luck as far as timing is concerned, and the tough luck came in the form of the Depression, the Democrats coming to power, and the fact that he was such a tried and true Republican. He was when Franklin first took office, as you say, he was Ted was still less than 50 years old, but already he could foresee that with the Democrats coming to power, it would be a very tough row to hoe for him to get back at and running for that office, even at the end of 8 years.
And yet he doesn't stay out of politics altogether, and this becomes especially clear as the decade comes to an end, and you have the specter of war rearing up again in Europe, and Ted Roosevelt steps up and gets into and steps onto the public stage once again. What position does he take with regard to the war in Europe?
Well, he got outside the mainstream of history, I think, here. He became a member of the America First movement, and he did so in part because he simply was still continuing war with Franklin, but also there were convictions involved, and he just felt convinced that America, the U.S., should not become involved in European conflicts, and this was something that he had become convinced of after the First World War, that he was not an isolationist, but he just did not think that American might should be committed lightly to European wars. He was, and I want to be clear that he was not he did not love history, and Hitler was never a proponent of fascism or Nazism, and actually his sympathies were always with Great Britain in the initial stages of the war. Yet he didn't want to commit U.S. blood and treasure to the campaign. There were a lot of people in the U.S. at the time who, and not just isolationists and not just conservatives, who were America firsters. There was a strong movement on the left, progressive movements who also resisted efforts to get into the war. No, that's not to make excuses for him, but just to explain that it was a pretty large and widespread movement at the time.
Yeah, it's interesting that in that respect, his position with regard to the Second World War is diametrically opposite of his father's in 1916, 1917 with regard to the First World War. And so too is their experience of stepping up and serving, because Theodore Roosevelt had tried to, as you describe in the book, tried to, get a command of a regiment when the U.S. went into war in 1917. Ted, when after Pearl Harbor, seeks a command, and unlike his father, he gets one.
Yeah, it is very ironic that their positions were so changed over that course of time. Ted's position, and Ted shared his father's sentiments during at the start of the First World War and before, but as suggested, Ted's ideas about World War II changed drastically, and just as you say, at the same time, the Roosevelt family was so committed to service that it didn't. There seemed to them no contradiction. There seemed to Ted no contradiction in volunteering for military duty at the same time as he was fighting in the America First movement to stay out of the war. He just didn't see any contradiction in that because he was so committed to service and to the idea that if this came to a necessity, if war came to a necessity, he was going to be the first in line. He would always be first in line. And this was a sentiment that was ingrained in him by his father and by his mother from childhood onward.
And when you say he's first in line, you're not just speaking metaphorically. You describe a very active war for him. And I was wondering if you could explain a bit as to what positions he served in during the war and some of the people that he dealt with during that service.
He was a remarkable figure in my estimation as far as his absolute need to be up front and out front and with his troops and as a commander. He was placed by an old friend, George Marshall, who had moved from being an acquaintance during the First World War to the U.S. Army in the Second World War. Marshall appointed him as assistant divisional commander assistant commander to the First Division, and Ted was assigned to all of the major campaigns at one time or another, working with the First Division. The commander of the First Division was a man named Terry Allen, a very colorful character. And they were in Operation Torch, which was the invasion of North Africa, and served throughout the North African campaign. Ted was at the front lines in Sicily. It was part of the amphibious invasion of Sicily in the summer of 1943. He served in Italy in the fall of 1943, and in all of these services, he was in numerous battles. Was again at the front lines at actions in North Africa, front line through the course of the campaign through Sicily, and then in the spring and early late winter of in 1944, he volunteered and was a persistent bug in the ear of his new commander, a man named Tubby Barton, in a new division, the 4th Division, to become a part of the invasion of Normandy in June of 1944.
He famously becomes the only American general to land at Normandy on the first day of battle, and you describe this very dramatic scene that's been fictionalized and is to a degree controversial as to who said what at that moment. But this famous moment where he's landing at Utah Beach and he discovers that things didn't exactly go according to plan.
Yeah, he had a 56-year-old gimpy general canes his way. He's carrying a cane to help assist him out of the landing craft at Utah Beach, and he spends much of the morning going back and forth directing troops on the sands of Utah Beach. But as he gets out of the craft initially, he and his compatriots discover that they have landed in the wrong spot on the beach. And Ted and the commanders of the other commanders at the beach gather to determine what to do, and they're hovering behind a tank just off the beach, and looking at maps, looking at at looking for the causeways that are going to lead them off the beach. And one of them, and Ted is always given credit, but it may be because he was just the most distinguished figure there, said, well, whatever the case, the war begins here. Mm-hmm. And they proceed from there.
The Gibbon issue
became very famous.
Yeah, it was. I first encountered it when I saw it on The Longest Day when Henry Fonda played Ted Roosevelt, and he just has him sort of, you know, throwing it as an offhand casual comment.
Yeah. Yeah, Henry Fonda, by the way, not an exact replica of Ted Roosevelt.
You have a picture in your book, which I thought was very striking, which is you have Ted Roosevelt standing next to George Patton, under whom he also served. And you have George Patton, who's towering over this very diminutive Ted Roosevelt.
I love that picture, yeah.
You mentioned the gimpiness, though, and that really gets to what happens at the very end, which is that by this point, as you describe, you know, Ted is not in the best of health, and it's not just the gimpiness caused by his old war wound from World War I, but he's suffering from quite a few other maladies as well.
He has heart disease. It's undiagnosed heart disease, but he has it, and he had just prior to arriving at England in preparation for the invasion of Normandy, he's hospitalized with a serious case of pneumonia that keeps him in the hospital for a full 3 weeks prior to going on to England. The pneumonia strikes him as he's en route from Italy to England. He also begins to have some chest pains, and these he confided to his son, another Quentin, who was served with Ted throughout North Africa and into England. Just on the eve of his death, Quentin wrote about it to his mother after Ted's death. And Ted, I think I've gotten ahead of myself here. Ted, subsequent to the invasion in Normandy, continues to serve for a month afterwards in Normandy before succumbing to a heart attack and dying.
Yeah. He had just received command of his own division, and then he has this heart attack, and he dies at the age of 56. So,
yep.
We've been taking up a good deal of your time, but I was wondering if you could tell us before you go what it is you're working on now.
You know, I am searching for a sub. I had thought for a time that I would switch from World War II histories to a Civil War story, but I'm finding myself steering back once again to World War II. But I haven't, I really haven't nailed a subject down yet.
Well, I hope
I thought, but never mind. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I hope that inspiration strikes you soon.
I hope it does as well.
Well, Tim Brady, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us today. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.